I'm very pleased tonight to have with us as our guest for the full 2 hours, Harvey Clare, who is a distinguished student of communism, more particularly of communism in the United States and the reaction to communism in the United States. He is the co-author, together with John Earl Haynes, of a brand new book titled In Denial, Historians, Communism, and Espionage. Earlier, he and the same co-author, John Haynes, did 2 books, one of them titled The Secret World of American Communism, and then Venona, Decoding Soviet Espionage in America. If I am correct, you are just about the first American to get into the Soviet files when they were opened up under Gorbachev's orders, I guess.
Well, actually, I was the first, and it took place in 1992. Fortuitously, I had made plans to go to Moscow to do other kinds of research. And I was there in the summer of 92, shortly after Boris Yeltsin actually decided to open the Russian archives.
After Yeltsin kicked Gorbachev out.
Right, and this was after the failed coup, and Yeltsin had seized the Communist Party's property and declared the Communist Party illegal. And this archive had been the property of the Soviet Communist Party, and Yeltsin was convinced that there was material in it that would discredit the party. So he opened it, and I was the first American to get in, and it was like a mouse in a cookie jar.
And Yeltsin was right. There was material in it to discredit not only the Soviet Communist Party, but in fact the American Communist Party.
Scads of it.
What did you find?
Well, I didn't know what I was looking for, and I started requesting files and started going through them, and coming across things that were, you know, a lot of fun, a lot of very interesting material indicating, for example, that the Soviet Union had been secretly subsidizing the American communists for decades. Lots of material about the control that the Soviet Party exercised over the American Party. Fascinating information about some prominent Americans, for example, Harry Bridges, the labor leader, who had always denied he was a communist. In fact, the government tried to deport him several times.
He was an Australian by origin, as I remember.
Right. And Bridges had swore under oath that he was not a communist, and there had been several 5-4 Supreme Court decisions preventing him from being deported. I found a document which indicated not only was he a communist, he was a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. But the most significant material that I found, I started coming across documents that were in Russian that were stamped top secret. Now, my Russian's pretty rudimentary. I'd had it in college, but it had been years since I'd used it. But I was working with a translator, and he started translating some of these documents, and I said, don't even bother to translate them. If they're stamped top secret, I'm taking them home with me. And so when I returned to Atlanta, I had 2 thick reels of microfilm, because they didn't have Xerox machines in the archive. And going through customs with all these reels of microfilm stamped top secret was a little nerve-wracking. But what these were KGB documents. And they were requests from the KGB to the Communist International for information on a number of Americans. And the thing that was startling was that these were Americans that had been named as spies.
Many of them named, as I remember from at least from the relevant chapter in your book, by Elizabeth Bentley,
right,
who was a former communist who turned and essentially became a federal witness.
Right. Bentley had been she was a somewhat flighty woman, not entirely reliable, hard drinker, and she had gone to work for the KGB. She had been recruited by a man who was her lover, who was actually one of the KGB's main agents in the United States, worked with the American Communist Party. And in 1945, her lover had died. The KGB had pushed her aside. She was bitter. And she went to the FBI, and she told them this incredible story about running several dozen people in various government departments in Washington.
Running in the sense of she being the agent in charge
of them.
Of other people who had sold out to or were secretly working for the Soviet Union, though they were in positions, some of them of considerable eminence in American government or other sectors of American life.
Right. I mean, she would go down to Washington and pick up documents that they had stolen or material that they had written out from things they'd seen, take it back to New York and hand it over to the Soviets.
Who were some of the best-placed or most well-placed people who were reporting to her and giving her those documents?
Well, there were several people, two of whom she never met, but they turned over documents to somebody who turned the documents over to her, and those were Lachlan Curry, who was a White House assistant to Franklin Roosevelt and later Harry Truman, and the other was Harry Dexter White, who was the second in command at the Treasury Department. Those were the two most highly ranked people that she was carrying their material.
Those are not small fish.
No, they're not. They're
but
very large fish.
What were they supplying?
Different kinds of material. Curry would pass along interesting economic information, information about presidential decisions. White was passing along very important material from the Treasury Department. White also passed along, we now know, from the Venona decryptions, which really Bentley had nothing to do with, but was additional confirmation. White would he was at the San Francisco conference where the United Nations was founded, and while he was out in San Francisco, he met with a KGB agent and informed him about the American negotiating position.
Mm-hmm. That's giving a great deal away.
It's useful information.
Do I remember correctly that the secretary functionary in that first meeting setting up the United Nations at San Francisco was Alger Hiss?
It was. And Hiss, of course, also was a Soviet agent, although Bentley didn't work with him.
Yeah. But Whitaker Chambers did.
Whitaker Chambers had worked with Hiss back in the 1930s. One of the questions about Hiss, even after Whitaker Chambers had exposed him and Hiss had been convicted of perjury, was whether and when Hiss had stopped working for Soviet espionage. Chambers quit in 1937, 1938, yeah. So he couldn't testify as to whether Hiss had continued working for the Russians.
Were there any people in military life or in Department of Defense positions,
yes,
who were in that group?
Yes.
Who were they?
There's a guy named William Ullman who worked for, I think he was with the Army Air Force. Mm-hmm. There were other people in various defense agencies, the Manpower Administration, people in Air Force Intelligence, all of whom were passing along vital defense information.
In what years? In what?
1943, 1944, 1945.
During the war?
During the war.
When the Soviet Union was our, quote, ally.
Was our ally, right. And this was just an extraordinary ring that Bentley was in charge of. They penetrated virtually every agency of the federal government. There's one sort of funny story that Bentley came back to New York to meet Jacob Golis, her lover and her KGB superior. And she reported that one of her sources had said, you know, worked for the OSS, which was the forerunner of the CIA. And this guy said, you know who I saw in the OSS office? He named some fellow. He said, I can't believe he's working for the OSS. He's an open communist. And Bentley reported this, and Golis said, oh, the fools, you know, this it's like having a guy with a hammer and sickle on his chest running around there. But there were so many spies that they were literally bumping into each other.
They were all spies, however, unlike the later ones who've been apprehended, like Ames and various others. They were spies on the basis of ideological conviction rather than on the basis of mere sociopathy or lust for money.
Oh, yeah. These people
were really communists.
They were idealists. They were doing it because they believed in the Soviet Union. They supported communism. They supported the Soviet Union. They didn't take money. Sometimes the Russians tried to give them money, and there's one funny story that one of the Russian KGB people talked about providing money, and Golis, I believe, was the person, maybe somebody else, said, you can't offer him money, he'll be insulted, to suggest that he's doing it for so pecuniary a reason.
Now, there was a vast amount of this stuff going on in the war years, in some of it in the years before World War II,
right,
much of it after World War II, and that's one of the things that you're dealing with in the book, In Denial.
Right.
But the title of the book refers not so much to the spies and not so much to the communist hierarchy within this country. It refers rather to the intellectuals, more particularly the historians of this country. They, in the main, have been in denial with regard to the communist penetration of American institutions and with regard, for that matter, to the evil of the Stalinist regime in the long run of Soviet history. They are denying what communism was and what it did within this country and what it did in massive violence against the various Soviet peoples.
Yeah, and the previous books that John Haynes and I did were really focused on the espionage, the activities of the American Communist Party. We were struck, though, by a lot of the reviews of our books by professional historians who, here were documents from the Russian archives, from the horse's mouth, saying, we control the American Communist Party. We financed the American Communist Party. We made and unmade the leadership of the party. We used the party as a front for espionage. All these people that were accused of being spies were spies. And the reaction of a lot of historians was, no, can't be. The documents are forgeries. The charges are nonsense. We're not going to believe it. We're going to stick our heads in the sand.
And on that other related matter of what Soviet life was really like and what the Stalinist regime really did, an early author who really, with documentation and with great fervor, clarified the extent of the Stalinist depredations, particularly as they occurred in the Ukraine, is Robert Conquest, a distinguished British historian and literary person as well. And he did a few books on that. And he, and for that matter, Solzhenitsyn, when he wrote to the Gulag Archipelago, and various others who disclosed the horrors of Stalinism, the genocidal activity of that long-running regime, that's been denied by lots of American historians as well.
Yeah, Conquest has been denounced and is still being denounced for exaggerating, for overstating the case, for being a tool of Ukrainian fascists, and so on. One of the stories we tell in the In Denial book is about the Katyn Forest massacre.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviet Union massacred 20,000 Polish POWs during World War II. The Russians tried to put the blame on the Germans, who had plenty of their own sins, of course. The American historical profession has simply refused to face up to this. Even today, you get historians writing about the supposed massacre. Well, the Russians have released material. The actual document, it's a memo from Beria to Stalin, and it says, we are holding 21,000 Polish POWs in the following camps, and it breaks them down by rank. And then it says, they are guilty of counter-revolutionary activity, and we recommend the highest possible punishment, shooting. And on the memo is the word handwritten, Da, and Stalin's signature, and the signature of every other member of the Soviet Politburo. We've never found a order by Hitler ordering the murder of Jews. Yet does anyone doubt Hitler's responsibility for the Holocaust and regard him as a moral monster? There are plenty of historians that simply won't credit Joseph Stalin.
There's a quote supposedly from Stalin. Now, whether it's apocryphal or not, I don't know, but you probably do. It runs something like this. I'm just remembering. There is nothing more pleasant than to go down a list of 10,000 enemies to be executed, to sign it, and then go to bed for a peaceful sleep.
I've heard that. I think it's not apocryphal. I think it's true. He certainly did it. And the fact that you can have distinguished historians holding distinguished positions in distinguished American universities.
One of them, the University of Chicago.
who minimized the crimes of Stalin, who for years argued that the number of victims was inflated, who come up with these bizarre explanations that it was a bureaucratic problem run amok.
Well, then we come to a very interesting question, a question that you pose quite early in the book, In Denial. Holocaust revisionism, which has been attempted by some nuts on the fringe and some strangely motivated people on the fringe, and some fantasts. Holocaust revisionism may flourish in fake little institutions in California, and may be pushed by rather aberrant non-academic historians in the UK, but it has taken no hold in American universities at all, except for Arthur Butts, professor of engineering at Northwestern University, a great embarrassment to that university, but he's got tenure, and they agree that by AAUP rules and by academic tradition, the tenure has to be maintained, though he's still an associate professor some 30 or 40 years into his academic career. But Holocaust revisionism doesn't take hold in the American universities. But Soviet revisionism and communist revisionism obviously is a legitimate undertaking, or a rewarded undertaking, in not only history departments, but I should think also in sociology and political science departments. Not that all members of such departments are apologists for communism or are looking the other way, but people like that are located in such departments. They're getting the usual academic rewards. They're having full, interesting careers, though they're dealing essentially with lies, or at least with evasion of the truth. Why the difference is the great question. Why, and that's the question we will address right after we pause for these words. Our guest tonight is Harvey Clare, who, together with John Earl Haynes, is the author of the new book, In Denial, Historians, Communism, and Espionage. One might have said American historians, communism and espionage in and from America. And I reinstate the question I posed just before we stopped for those commercials. Why is Holocaust revisionism taboo in the American university world, while communism revisionism, if that's what one might call it, is legitimated and essentially deemed to be acceptable and even worth proper rewards?
It's a tough question, the fact is it is acceptable. In our book, we quote from a guy named Theodore von Lau, who is the Francis and Jacob Hyatt Professor of European History Emeritus at Clark University, an endowed chair. In 1999, he admonished historians, quote, "The sophisticated design of Soviet totalitarianism has perhaps not been sufficiently appreciated. However brutal, it was a remarkable human achievement despite its flaws. Though he knew how to act his public role, Stalin himself retained a sense of fallibility and imperfection, remaining remarkably humble," end quote. Now, can you imagine a historian writing that about Hitler? Substitute Hitler for Stalin.
Exactly so.
That person would be regarded in the academy as a moral pariah. And yet, this was published in a distinguished historical journal.
And Stalin, we now know from a demographic research conducted by people like Rudolf Rommel and various others, killed more people in genocide and democide, as Rommel calls it, than Hitler did.
Right. Many more.
He had a longer time.
He had a lot longer time. And, you know, he was an equal opportunity killer. You know, Stalin killed more Jews than anybody in history except Hitler. Mm-hmm. He certainly killed more Ukrainians, more Letts, Lithuanians.
And more communists.
And more communists. He killed more communists than anybody except maybe Mao. Mao possibly got more. That's a really tough question that you posed. I think part of it is because to many historians, communism remains a movement of the left. It's a familial kind of movement. Even if they're not communists, they feel some kind of familial attachment to it. You know, the old saying back in the 1930s, people said, you know, a communist is just a liberal in a hurry. Well, I think there's some people foolish enough to believe that.
Of course, communism, going way back to its roots in Marxism, always professed humane ideals. Nazism and fascism never did. Mussolini's fascism at the beginning was built on the notion that the state must control everything. The state is all, the organic state, and further that the state, the people, find their fulfillment only in war. War is necessary to refresh the patriotic fervor of the people. Hitler had all that, the crazed biological madness and all the racial theory, and from the very beginning, in Mein Kampf, written in 1924 or thereabouts, is talking about how Germany must march to the east and kill and thin out the population of the east to find its own needed Lebensraum, living space. So there the purposes as stated are in a way antithetical to human values, whereas communism professes, doesn't achieve, but professes human values.
That's true, although if you go back and read Marx, Marx and Engels often talk in their writings and their correspondence about the need to exterminate inferior populations.
Yeah.
And they have an undeserved, I think, reputation as humanitarians, but they did talk a better game.
I once had on this program a well-known American communist. She didn't rank highly in the party, but she wrote about having been a member of the Communist Party. She was well known as a literary figure, Jessica Mitford, one of the Mitford girls. Most of the others were fascists and Nazis, including Unity Mitford, her sister, who was in love with, who thought she loved Hitler and who committed suicide because Hitler didn't pay her enough attention. But Jessica Mitford lived out in Los Angeles. She married a Jewish guy who was some sort of labor lawyer, I think. And she was a member of the Communist Party in a cell out there. She did a book about it later on.
Right.
And it's all very nostalgic about what wonderful people these were. They weren't interested in, they had nothing to do with Stalin's Russia, really. What they were doing was pursuing social justice for labor, for Mexicans, what have you. And they had the joy of the comradeship of people working, commonly working for the good. A very different picture of what the American Communist Party was. Did Jessica Mitford believe all of that? Was she a dupe, or was she an agent of the party?
No, I'm sure she believed that, and I think lots of people that joined the Communist Party were very well-meaning people, and they were idealistic people, and they're very decent people.
Even sort of nice people.
Even nice people.
Yeah.
A lot of times I'll get reaction from people. They'll say, "But my grandfather was in the and my uncle," and they were wonderful, warm people. Sure they were. Lots of people joined the Communist Party because they believed in labor unions, because they were opposed to fascism, because they believed in equal rights for blacks. The thing is, though, that if you were to stay in the Communist Party for any length of time, you had to be ready to change your opinions, because the party changed its line on an average every 2 or 3 years. If you joined the Communist Party because you were opposed to fascism and the communists were opposed to fascism, well, you had to swallow the Nazi-Soviet pact. If you joined the party because you believed in labor unions, well, you had to swallow the fact that the party adopted a no-strike pledge. If you joined the party because you believed in equal rights for blacks, you had to swallow the fact that the party downplayed it at various times for other kinds of reasons. There was only one constant in Communist Party doctrine, and that was support of the Soviet Union and Soviet foreign policy. Anybody who was in the party for any length of time had to know that.
And you make clear, and it's visible in the documentation that you turned up in the Moscow archives of the Communist Party, that the leadership of the party was, in fact, not merely influenced by the Comintern and by the men up the Kremlin, but reported to them. They were part of that structure.
Absolutely. And did their bidding and served as recruiters for espionage. I mean, that's absolutely clear. We did one of our early books, and I was on a call-in show on NPR, Talk of the Nation, and we got a call from Berkeley, California, and it was a guy who was actually a fairly prominent communist, and he was indignant. He's yelling, "I was in the party for 40 years, and I never heard about espionage. I was never involved in espionage. This is, your slander, McCarthyism." And my response was, "I don't understand why you're mad at me. You were a member of a party whose leaders used you and other idealistic people as a front for espionage. Why aren't you mad at them?"
What was his answer to that?
He didn't answer it.
Yeah. It is curious. What's even more curious is that the party is still there. As you know, just before we started, I brought up on my computer, on the internet, the party's website. And it's there. It's Communist Party USA, easily available to anybody. And they're still essentially spouting the same line. And they've got members, apparently. They've still got a structure of appointed, or are they elected leaders? I don't know. They're no longer appointed by the Comintern, that's clear.
That's right. And they've had a lot of problems in the last decade. We now know from Russian documents that the Soviet Union was subsidizing them as late as 1986 or 87. And then Gus Hall, the party leader at the time, made a mistake. He criticized perestroika and glasnost, and Gorbachev cut him off. They were getting $3 million a year in the late 80s, which is not a bad amount of money for a party that had maybe 5,000 members. After the Soviets cut them off, the People's Weekly World, their party newspaper, I'm sorry, the People's Daily World became the People's Weekly World. The party is struggling now. It only has a couple thousand members. They were badly hurt by the collapse of the Soviet Union. After the Soviet Union collapsed, somebody asked Gus Hall what advice he would give to communists, and he said, well, they should vacation in North Korea now. You know, when you're reduced to North Korea as your model country, I think you're in deep trouble. The party is not a factor in American life anymore.
But something that is a factor in American life is another brand of leftism that developed in this country in the late 1960s and on through the 70s, commonly called the New Left. The people who strongly protested the Vietnam War, who founded the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, ultimately the Weathermen, and various other such organizations, and who, in large number, went on in graduate studies and got their doctorates and became, ultimately, assistant professors. They are all of them now full professors, if they've lasted in academic life. Many are deans, deanlets, and even perhaps a few college presidents. And that has created the climate within the universities which tolerates and encourages and rewards the sort of communist revisionism that we were talking about earlier. We need to talk about that movement. If the Communist Party isn't significant, the New Left, now the middle-aged old New Left, has had tremendous consequence for American university life and beyond that for the American dialogue generally, because the universities are heard. And they have considerable influence upon what all the rest of this country thinks and how this the rest of this country values and judges. So, after another commercial break, let's talk about the New Left in this context and connect them to the picture that you've been developing. Okay. We return directly to Harvey Clare, a co-author of In Denial. I should have said, by the way, that book is published by Encounter Books, and we return right after this. And directly back to Harvey Clare, who, together with John Earl Haynes, is the author of the new book, In Denial, Historians, Communism and Espionage, that book published by Encounter Books. And let us come to the New Left, now the middle-aged old New Left or whatever, but how they fit into this whole picture.
Well, I think that you're right. The Communist Party is no longer particularly important in American life, but what's happened is that there's a cadre of historians, many of them veterans of the New Left, who, beginning in the 1970s, as they entered the academy, set out to rehabilitate communism. And part of it was a search for their own kind of radical roots and trying to understand where they'd gone wrong. And here was the Communist Party, this organization that had managed to survive for a long time in capitalist America. And they began to see some of the virtues of communism. And so you had this revisionist movement among historians that portrayed American communism as a genuinely democratic movement.
Don't we have to note that they earlier portrayed America as America with a K, as an evil imperialist racist power which was intrinsically no good and which had violated its own founding documents?
Yes, and of course the explanation, why had America rejected communism? Because America was a repressive, racist society. McCarthyism. The communists had been persecuted and prosecuted, and that was the reason that Americans had turned away from the left, not because of anything that communism stood for, but rather because of these wild and false charges. And so you had this debate, this argument among students of American communism between what in our book we call the traditionalists, people like Theodore Draper, Irving Howe, and myself, and sort of these people coming out of the New Left. And quite frankly, they won, because graduate students more and more came to adopt that perspective. But then they had a problem, and the problem came with the opening of the Russian archives, because all the arguments they made, the American Communist Party was this democratic, indigenous political movement that was really not controlled from Moscow, turned out to be wrong. the American Communist Party was controlled from Moscow. The party was as fundamentally corrupt as the traditionalists
had
said.
There were no communists, American communist spies. That was McCarthyism,
that
which
was
had falsely accused them.
Right. And, you know, Alger Hiss was innocent. He was framed. The Rosenbergs were framed. That was anti-Semitism that had led to their execution. The charges that Elizabeth Bentley had made against Harry Dexter White and Lachlan Curry were fantasies. This was, America had gone hysterical. There was nothing to these charges. It turned out they were wrong. They were just dead, dead wrong.
And how did these folks account for the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Well, the different explanations. For some of them were not terribly sympathetic to the Soviet Union, and they didn't want to be burdened by Stalinism. For some of them, it was America had spent the Soviet Union into bankruptcy. For others, Gorbachev was the man that had ended the Cold War. Gorbachev was the hero. Ronald Reagan was the great villain of this piece. But they didn't want to spend a lot of time worrying about the collapse of the Soviet Union. They were upset by it. One of the things we talk about in the book, one of the charges against us in our early books, we're accused of something called triumphalism, which is that we're happy that the United States won the Cold War, which is just a remarkable charge.
Actually, I'm not too unhappy over that fact.
Neither am I. Again, the comparison with the study of Germany. Is there a historian? What would one think of a historian that was not happy that the Nazis lost? It's mind-boggling.
Well, of course, with regard to the Cold War itself, there was a whole group of historians quite early on in the first, as I remember it, by the 1950s, who developed a view of the Cold War as essentially the two sides may be equally guilty, but the U.S. is more equal than is the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and
what's the name of that fellow down in Tennessee who did a big three-volume revisionist history of the Cold War itself? Maybe Tennessee or one of those border state universities.
It's not coming
doesn't
to mind.
Matter.
But one of the historians that has defended Harry Dexter White. He finally admits that Harry Dexter White was a Soviet spy. The evidence is too overwhelming. But then he says, he spied in a good cause because he spied for, he was trying to preserve Roosevelt's vision of a post-war world. He was trying to prevent the United States from becoming a hegemonic power. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, was terrible, would have been terrible. You have the widow of a atomic spy, Ted Hall, who has said that her husband deserves credit for preventing World War III by helping the Soviet Union get the atomic bomb.
And Ted Hall, this will be of interest to our listeners in this region, was a worker, a very young worker, at the Manhattan Project when it started at the University of Chicago. He was there with Fermi splitting the atom, and he carried very important secrets about atomic technology to the Soviets quite early in the game.
Oh, yeah. Hall was, he was a physics genius. He was recruited to Los Alamos right after he graduated at age 19 from Harvard. He was the youngest physicist at Los Alamos, and he immediately began spying for the Russians.
But he did spend some time with Fermi at the University of Chicago as well.
He may well have.
Yeah, he did.
And I know he came back to Chicago after the war.
That's
and,
true.
When the forerunner of the National Security Agency decrypted a Venona telegram, which named Hall in plain text, didn't even use a code name for him, named him as an atomic spy, they immediately began looking around. Where was this guy? And they discovered he was in graduate school at the University of Chicago, and he was sharing an office with Edward Teller.
He had a long career both in the Soviet Union, then he wound up in England, and he died peacefully.
He never went to the Soviet Union. He did not go to the Soviet Union. No, he went to England, died just a few years ago.
Right.
Justifying what he had done on the grounds that by ensuring a nuclear stalemate, he had prevented World War III. He was quite proud of what he had done.
You've been talking about the profession of history in this country, academically based historians. Historians of the Renaissance don't get involved in matters of this sort. Historians of ancient China don't get involved in matters of this sort. Historians of sort of modern European history, I suppose, do. And there may be some historians who specialize, in fact, in the study of communism and the communist movement.
Right. And but actually, historians of the Renaissance, no, but professors of English do.
Well, explain that.
Well, I suppose one way to explain it is there, you know, there are more Marxists maybe in English history departments than there are in the rest of America.
In English departments?
English departments,
yeah. How does that happen to be the case?
I wish I knew. There's an attraction of intellectuals for Marxism, and it's some of them seem to carry it over from a purely academic pursuit to an admiration of Stalinism. One of the most prominent literary critics in the United States, Frederick Jameson, who's a professor of English at Duke University, has written articles defending Stalin. He's an English professor. I quoted Professor von Laue. Now he's a history professor. There's an English professor at, of all places, Montclair State University, that on an online history discussion group constantly defends Stalin and Stalinism. I suppose it's no odder than an Arthur Butz in electrical engineering defending Hitler.
It runs very widely across the range of humanities departments, at least, and also social science departments, so-called. I, in my rather long academic career, have certainly encountered many leftist, left-oriented sociologues, and to be sure, professors of English, professors of Romance languages, and so on. And it is honored. Whether one agrees or disagrees, colleagues tend to see this as probably it's desirable to have a good, fierce Marxist on your faculty. It gives you a sense of range and color and representation of all the different flowers blooming.
Yeah, I'd be more sympathetic to that argument if those same people were excited about having an honest conservative on the faculty as
exactly,
well.
To be sure.
But quite often, while they'd like to have two or three or many Marxists, the idea of letting 100 flowers bloom does not include those flowers
these days.
On
that
the,
is
on the
that
right.
Is certainly the case. But what would you do about the presence of the kinds of people you're now talking about? Surely you would not want, you're an academic, I'm an academic, you wouldn't want to deny them tenure because they are disposed to make excuses for Stalinism or disposed to make excuses for or paint a glowing picture of the American Communist Party. Or would you?
No, but you know, I think that in the profession of history, I think there's certain academic standards that you have to uphold. In our book, we talk about how you have historians that are distorting evidence, that are lying about evidence,
and know they're lying,
misquoting documents, mistranslating documents. We had some historians who denounced us, claiming we had mistranslated documents from the Russian archives. They admitted they had not seen the original Russian documents, but they knew we were misquoting them, mistranslating them. And when we printed the actual Russian documents, then they just go on to their next point. You have historians that simply are lying, and that I think is kind of academic misconduct. Now, would I want to fire somebody who has different political views than mine, even if they're abhorrent? No. But I think that when historians practice bad history, there should be consequences.
Well, there is such a thing as distorted perception. You may produce something which is grossly untrue because you are willfully misperceiving. And then there is conscious lying. They're not the same thing. But they may produce the same kind of product.
Right.
Yeah. How can you prove the one rather than the other?
It can be hard, but for example, take the case my colleague at Emory, Deborah Lipstadt, who was sued in England by David Irving, a Holocaust revisionist.
Mm-hmm.
And Deborah and her lawyers were able to demonstrate that David Irving was a fraud. He misused documents. You know, you could say if somebody is kind of just a sloppy historian, they'll make all kinds of mistakes in all different directions. But she and her lawyers were able to prove that all his mistakes went in one direction. And that was a pretty decisive evidence. It was enough for the judge that he was not a competent historian. I think that if you had somebody in a history department that denied the Holocaust took place, you could fire that person, not because he denies the Holocaust took place, but because he's an incompetent historian.
Then why should you not fire an Arthur Butz for saying that and saying it in print?
Well, because he's an
Because he's a
electrical
professor of
engineer.
engineering.
Yeah, if he were, if you had a chemistry professor that was teaching Aristotle's theory of phlogiston, my guess is the chemistry department would fire him as an incompetent chemist.
Excellent point. One thing you deal with as well in the book, I haven't made much of this, but we should make mention of it. Some of our listeners may want to pick up on it, is the guilt of various spies, but Alger Hiss. And I remind you that, I suppose you know this, that at one American college, at Bard College in New York, there is an Alger Hiss chair. What is it in? A chair in history? Or?
I think in social studies.
An Alger Hiss chair in social studies, now occupied by?
Joel Covell, who is somebody we talk about, has denounced all kinds of anti-communism as forms of mental illness. I mean, he's got a book in which he argues that, Hubert Humphrey was mentally ill, and J. Edgar Hoover, and all anti-communists.
How do you get to a staff? Who funds a chair named for Alger Hiss?
I don't know. Maybe the Soviet Union. No, I'm sure it was some American admirer of Alger Hiss. But that is remarkable. It's, like the Benedict Arnold Chair in Revolutionary War
history.
What
should one think of a college which accepts the funding to set up a chair named for Alger Hiss?
Not very much.
The president of that college is a much celebrated character who runs around conducting symphony orchestras and aspiring to be president of larger universities, but he's never made it beyond Bard.
Yeah, Leon Botstein.
Yeah.
I think it's a disgrace. Why an American university would accept money to honor a man convicted of perjury only because the statute of limitations on espionage had run out. As I say, it is like having a Benedict Arnold chair in American history. I guess they found somebody competent to fill it, somebody who hates the United States, as Joe Covell does.
Well, see, that suggests, though, that there's a generally accepting climate in the academic world. Botstein, whatever he is or isn't, is not a member of the Communist Party, and he sometimes even claims to be a conservative, but I think he falsely claims that. But
yeah, people are willing
to... But if you can be nice to communists, that sort of marks you as sort of a good person.
Yeah, the University of Washington has a Harry Bridges chair in American labor history.
No, I didn't know that.
Yes. Honoring a man who we now know was a perjurer and a secret member of the Central Committee of the American Communist Party.
It is time to pause for some commercials and a quick update on the news, and then we shall return. But first, it is also time to invite telephone calls. We're opening the lines. The number, of course, is 591-7200, 591-7200. Any question that comes to mind as you hear this discussion? If there are any former communists or present communists, members of the party, who want to join in the conversation, they would be most welcome. 591-7200. Get your calls in right now if you are so inclined, and we will return after this. And we will be on to the phones shortly. The phone number, 591-7200. All the lines were filled a moment ago, but we tend to edit rather closely, and not everybody makes the cut. There are now a number of lines available again. If you've been trying to reach us, do make another try quickly. 591-7200. If you're listening at a great distance, particularly if you're listening over the internet in another country, or for that matter in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, somebody called us from there just a few nights ago, then you can reach us by email quite easily. The email address, extension 720 as one word, at tribune.com. Extension 720 at tribune, tribune.com, or 591-7200. I'd like to establish, where possible, sort of a cross-national comparison. If we look at the other countries that are more or less like us in terms of the values they supposedly live by and their degree of corporate culture and post-industrial development, the current countries of West Europe, Canada, Australia, do we find similar patterns there?
In terms of the
In
history.
terms of tolerance for communism and continuing revisionist support for even for the idea of the Soviet Union.
Yes. You know, just this last year, Eric Hobsbawm published his autobiography, a very, very distinguished and prominent British historian and longtime member of the Communist Party. He stayed in the party almost to the very end, I think to the very end. There was a very, very significant communist historians group in Britain, same thing in France.
And are they honored by the other academic colleagues?
Yes. You know, there's some countries I'm not as aware of, but certainly Britain and France, they're fierce debates in all those countries now, also because of the revelations that are coming out of Russian archives.
What further revelations have appeared in recent years?
Well, stuff has slowed down, in part because Russia has been much more limited in what they're letting people look at.
They've begun to clamp down on the archives again.
Yeah. I was lucky when I first went into the archives. They were very welcoming to me. They gave me everything I asked for. And when I came back a year or so later, it was a lot tighter, and I asked somebody why, and the response was, well, they were so nice to you because they thought you must be an American communist. They couldn't figure out why anybody else would be interested in this stuff, and they found out you weren't. But the other reason is that as the political situation in Russia began to get worse, as sort of the heady optimism of the early Yeltsin years began to fade, they began to clamp down more.
Mm. If you'd put on the headset and adjust the volume with the little knob below the table on your left, I should have told you that while we were in the commercial break. We will go to the phones as soon as I do the same. The phone number, 591-7200, and here is the first caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. It seems like McCarthy was actually a benefit to the communists of the United States for the following reason. After the McCarthy period, everyone was afraid to call a communist. For the past 40 years, up until rather recently, I don't recall someone being referred to as a communist. It's just lately that people are saying these are communists who are behaving this way and they're working against our country. I was wondering what your opinion would be of that.
I think you're absolutely correct. I think Joe McCarthy was one of the great disasters for the cause of anti-communism. There were plenty of responsible anti-communists. Joe McCarthy was an irresponsible anti-communist. He was a demagogue. He made wild, unsubstantiated charges. And it's like a kind of Gresham's Law. The bad charges tended to drive out the good ones, so that if people got accused of being communists, even if they were, the response was McCarthyism.
Thank you.
We thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you. 591-7200 is the number. You are next on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. I wanted to inquire of your author if he could relate in any way to the possibility that there was a communist infiltration in the 1968 riots. On Channel 11, as a matter of fact, they had a panel of students who had participated, and one of them readily admitted that he was a communist and had been instructed to encourage this. And it was the only time I ever heard anything about it. Firstly,
now, which 1968 riots are you referring to?
At the Democratic Convention.
Oh, here in Chicago.
In Chicago.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I just wanted to say that I was very fortunate in college to have Elizabeth Bentley as my American government teacher after her conversion.
Where was that?
Mundelein College in Chicago.
Oh, she taught here at Mundelein.
Yes,
I
exactly.
I didn't know that.
I think she taught until she died. Anyway, she was an excellent teacher, and she was really a wonderful resource. And someone that we could believe in and begin to understand communism.
In regard to your second point, there's actually two new biographies of Elizabeth Bentley that have come out in the last year. She was a long neglected figure, and I think one of the disgraces of the Academy was that as so important a figure as Bentley, nobody wanted to write about her. But there's a book by Catherine Olmsted called, I think, Red Spy Queen. And another book by a woman named Lauren Kessler, whose title I can't recall, both of which have come out in the last year about Bentley. About the first point, It was certainly true that some of the people involved in the 1968 riots had gone to Cuba. They had been they'd gone down there for training and propaganda work. I don't think that most of that, though, came from communists. Most of the people that were involved in that were anarchists, revolutionaries who might have been Marxist or had Marxist-Leninist ideas, but were not members of the Communist Party.
Okay, thank you.
Well, we thank you, ma'am. Glad to have heard from you. 591-7200 is the number. Some lines available again. Get your calls in if you want to be heard. Let me read you an email. It's a little long, but the point is of considerable interest. The left's fascination with totalitarianism has not ended. There have been new alliances forged between the left, especially in Europe, and radical Islam, which in its essentials is totalitarian. It would seem that the program of radical Islam, oppression of women, religious control of education, lack of respect for human rights, and I must pause. Sorry for that, but I'm having a little trouble. He goes on to ask whether the left's deep affinity for totalitarian violence has found a new cause to embrace.
Well, I think there is something to that, but it's also not the first time that the left has been sympathetic to various kinds of fascist or neo-fascist kinds of movements. In the late 1920s and early 1930s, the Communist Party followed a doctrine called the Third Period, in which they argued that the Nazis were not a real serious threat or problem. Of course, in 1939 to 1941, the Communists were allied with the fascists. So it's not the first time that the radical left has looked to allies on what seems to be the far right.
My apologies to all who are listening for breaking out in a cough, and we're going to pause for some commercials while I try to clear my throat, and then we will return to conversation with Harvey Clare and with you on the phones, 591-7200. And we return to your calls for and to Harvey Clare, the co-author of the book In Denial, which is the basis for our conversation tonight. 591-7200, you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg, and thank you for a wonderful program. A question for your guest. I was speaking with a former Soviet citizen just the other night who informed me with great certitude that he was aware of an author who claimed that the Soviet Union was about to attack Germany just before the outbreak of World War II, or the German invasion of the Soviet Union. He gave me the author's name. I went and did some research and found him associated with a lot of the right-wing sites. The man's name, he uses the pseudonym Suvorov. He's a defected GRU agent. I wonder if your guest is familiar with any of that work.
I'm not, but I wouldn't put much credence in it. All the indications are that Stalin was utterly stunned when the Germans attacked. And one of the reasons that the regime almost collapsed was that the Soviets were utterly unprepared. If they were getting ready to attack, they had made absolutely no provision for it.
Well, he had managed to kill off almost all of his generals.
Absolutely. The Soviet army was in tatters.
He killed Marshal Tukhachevsky and the whole
Soviet High Command.
Soviet High Command.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
We thank you, sir. Glad to have heard from you. Another email. I'm very glad the author wrote his book. 60 years after the war, we're still hunting down Nazis in South America, and we certainly ought to. But the world's nations should hunt down former Soviet authorities for murdering millions and millions of people. Don't you agree?
I do. And there's one example we talk about in the book that I feel very passionately about, and it's something that most Americans don't know about. In the 1930s, several thousand Americans of Finnish descent moved to the Soviet Union, to Soviet Karelia, which is an area north of Leningrad, right next to Finland. And they were encouraged by the Soviet authorities, who wanted to industrialize the area and needed skilled labor. And there was something in the United States called Karelian fever. As I say, thousands of American and Canadian Finns moved to Soviet Karelia. In the purges of the late 1930s, those Finns got caught up, and a couple thousand of them disappeared into the gulag. In the early 1990s, Memorial, a Soviet society dedicated to remembering the victims of the Gulag, uncovered a mass grave in Karelia with several thousand bodies. The people in them had been stripped to their underwear, their hands and feet had been tied, and had been shot once in the back of the head. They also located records of who was buried in this plot, and there were several hundred Americans. These were American citizens murdered. Most of them were adult males, but there were women, there were children, 16, 17-year-olds. These were American citizens murdered in cold blood.
By, on the basis of what logic or meta-logic?
They were accused of being American spies.
So why were they accused of that?
Well,
when obviously they weren't.
This was the height of the Great Purges, and anybody with any foreign connections was suspect, and of course these people had come from America. The American Communist Party covered it up. The Soviets never talked about it. And several hundred Americans were murdered. There's been virtually nothing in the American press about this when the bodies were discovered. There was one short AP story, I believe. Again, can you imagine if we discovered a mass grave of American citizens in Nazi Germany? I think there justifiably would be demands that there be an investigation. Are any of those killers still alive? Can they be brought to justice?
Are you suggesting then that not only the American Academy, but also the American press is rather prone to giving the communists a pass?
Well, I on this issue, yes. I just find it astounding that you can locate a mass grave with hundreds of Americans and nobody seems to care.
There is the matter we discussed at the very beginning, though murder and totalitarianism and spying against your own nation, all of them are supposedly anathema to any decent person who's judging intelligently. But we have made a long-standing exception or a long-standing differentiation between fascism, Nazism on the one hand, and communism on the other.
That's right. And morally, I don't see that there's any distinction. I don't see how we can make a distinction.
I mentioned earlier the work of Rudolf Rommel. I'm sure you know it
Yes.
even better than I do. Can you summarize what he found?
Well, Rommel has found that communist regimes have killed millions and millions more people than the Nazis. He's looked at, you know, different methods of killing. He's looked at you know, what percentage of the population you kill, what percentage of the population you kill in a given year. All of these standards, the communist regimes are the worst offenders.
And indeed, the worst offender turns out, is it Mao or is it Stalin?
It may be Mao.
I think it's Mao.
Yes.
He has the largest number of murders or facilitated deaths, since a great deal of the dying in China was done by starvation.
That's right.
As was also true for a portion of Soviet history. Certainly the Ukraine exterminations were essentially carried out through starvation, though you would shoot a few thousand down in a ditch now and again just to kind of make your point.
That's right. But, you know, the thing, again, that many people don't realize is that Hitler often credited the Soviet gulag with providing him with a model for his own concentration camps. The gulag came first.
And supposedly they both had respect for one another, Stalin and Hitler.
Yes, they did.
Grudging respect.
That's right. They knew like-minded people.
Lord Bullock, who's a great historian of Nazism, as you remember, did a book about 7 or 8 years ago in which he compares a parallel biography in the Plutarchian style of Hitler and Stalin. And he was our guest. And I wasn't bright enough to ask the question, but I read about it. Some English reporter had asked him, so I repeated it to him. If you had to spend a weekend with either Hitler or Stalin, which one would you choose? And his answer was, oh, Hitler, of course. I would have been dreadfully bored. He was a very unpleasant man. but I would have emerged alive. If I had gone to Stalin's dacha for a weekend, I don't know whether I would have come out in a coffin or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he was very busy killing all of his own people.
Right.
And, as well as everybody else.
And you know, and you have people, I vividly remember in the late 1960s, people praising Mao, talking about he wrote such lovely poetry.
Yes. Yeah. back to the phones, 591-7200. Good evening.
Yeah, in the early 60s, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, they were becoming concerned that Martin Luther King was moving close to some communist advisors. I think he had a prominent lawyer working with him, they suspected. And there were a series of wiretaps and thugs authorized. Do you know, has anyone ever obtained transcripts of those tapes, or have you ever seen them, like, under the FOI action?
Yes. There's actually a colleague of mine at Emory named David Garrow wrote a book called The FBI and Martin Luther King Jr. And then had a, that was back in the mid-80s, and just a couple of years ago wrote an article for The Atlantic within the past 3 years about recent releases of those tapes. And it's fascinating material. You're absolutely correct. The FBI actually became very worried because they learned that a man named Stanley Levison was Martin Luther King's closest advisor. And not only had Levison been a member of the Communist Party, but the FBI knew that Levison was the bag man for the party. He was laundering Soviet funds that were coming into the United States, going to the American Communist Party. And the FBI was worried, and the Kennedy administration was frantic about that information, because, you know, was the Soviet Union supplying money to King? Was some of that Soviet money making its way to King? Was Levison some kind of Soviet mole? And so that's the reason that the FBI began to wiretap King. And they became even more suspicious when President Kennedy and Robert Kennedy actually urged King to break ties with Levison without telling him exactly why. And King assured them he would, and then the wiretaps revealed that he was maintaining secret contact with Levison, so that fueled additional suspicion about King.
I also understand that a lot of what they recorded had more to do with his marital infidelity than communist ties, but he kind of gets a free pass on that in the press.
Well, it did. I mean, there was no indication that King was a communist. He wasn't. But the bugs did reveal that he was having extramarital affairs, and the FBI tried to use that to blackmail King.
Well, in fact, worse than that, they sent him a letter suggesting that he'd kill himself.
That's right.
Or else all of this would be released.
Right.
Would you tell me your colleague's name again? Garrow?
David Garrow, G-A-R-R-O-W.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We thank you, sir. And to another caller quickly on 591-7200. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm thinking, speaking of revisionist history, I'm wondering what your guest thinks the review of history will have on the recent presidential election in Florida.
Explain your point a little bit more fully.
Well, the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune eventually came out with the results of their long count, which showed that if the overcounts had been counted as well as the undercounts, then actually Al Gore would have been president. But that has gotten very little press over the years. There's an excellent film that actually was touted on Rick Kogan's show on your station entitled Unprecedented, which specifically goes back and looks at some of the press records of the issues involved in Florida. And it seems to me to be a situation where it's not the left that's covering up. It seems to be the right that's working with the media not to reveal, or at least not to promote, the fact that if all the votes had been counted in Florida, we would have had a different presidential result.
Well, I'm sure that historians are going to go over that material many, many, many times, and I doubt very much that it's going to be covered up.
And we thank you, sir, for the call, and we pause for the usual reasons, and then directly back to the phones on 591-7200. And if you want to email us, that, of course, is available in virtual infinite supply, whatever virtual infinity means. And you can reach us via email at extension720@tribune.com. And we will go shortly back to the phones. But you will indulge me perhaps on the basis of some special interest, I ask you about one case which you do, in fact, discuss in the book, and which indeed produced a very general reaction of denial, which persists to this day. And I speak of the Rosenbergs. And I have to make clear, of course, that I'm not talking about relatives of mine, though I once made a joke and called him Uncle Julius, and a few people believed me. But the guilt of the Rosenbergs, you're quite convinced that that was established.
Yeah, I think it was established at the trial, and the material that's emerged in the years since only confirms it. When the Venona material was released in the mid-1990s, there were a number of messages that referred directly to Julius and Ethel Rosenberg by name, not even using Julius's code name, which ironically was Liberal. There's just no doubt. And then in the late 1990s, a man named Alexander Feklasov, who had been the Rosenbergs' KGB controller, appeared on television, and then he later wrote a book. And Feklasov said he did this because he, Feklasov, was still a dedicated communist, and he wanted to honor Julius for his wonderful contributions to the Soviet Union and his idealism.
But it is true that we had the denial syndrome fully in play with regard to the Rosenbergs from the very beginning, and I think really down to the present.
Absolutely. We talk in our book about people that were denying the Rosenbergs were guilty at the time of their trial, which, you know, you can understand that, I suppose.
Well, one could readily agree that the sentence was too severe.
Yes, certainly in the case of Ethel, at least.
Yeah.
Just a couple of years ago, the Dictionary of American Biography, which is sort of the classic reference work on American biography, commissioned somebody, a historian, to write the entry on the Rosenbergs. And who did they choose? A man named Norman Markowitz. He's a tenured professor at Rutgers University and a self-proclaimed member of the Communist Party. And Professor Markowitz did not disappoint. He wrote a entry for this standard work, which is on the reference shelves of major libraries, and you know, somebody who knows nothing about the Rosenbergs this is the first place they would go to. He never mentioned that they were members of the Communist Party. He suggested they were
really.
How
do you do that in a biographical note on the Rosenbergs?
They were active in left-wing circles.
I see.
He suggested that they were executed because they were Jews, and he simply ignored all the evidence that has come out indicating that they were guilty.
Just the other night, I caught a bit of the Angels in America dramatization on television. And to be sure, as Roy Cohn is dying, one of the figures that appears to him as a sepulchral Ethel Rosenberg, played by Meryl Streep, of all people, incredibly made up and dressed so that she literally looks like the pictures we've seen of Ethel Rosenberg. But the way the whole thing is written, she was a victim of Cohn's, and clearly the implication is she was innocent.
Yeah. Again, it's clear from the Venona messages that Ethel Rosenberg technically was guilty of conspiracy to commit espionage, which is what she was charged with. She knew about her husband's work. She helped recruit her own brother. So she was guilty of conspiracy. She was a very minor figure, and we now know that the government indicted her and put her on trial as a means to try to put pressure on Julius.
Yeah.
It failed. The Rosenbergs could have saved themselves had they confessed. For years, their defenders argued, well, they couldn't confess because they were innocent. They couldn't lie. So that's why they went to their deaths. Well, we know now they were guilty. They didn't confess not because they were innocent. They didn't confess because they were dedicated Stalinists. And, their sons have continued to insist on their innocence.
The Mirapol brothers.
The Mirapol brothers. Yeah. And it's quite sad. I mean, it's one thing, there's something admirable in sticking up for your parents, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it's one thing to say, my parents were killed by the government, which framed them. It's something else. The Mirapols have, to this day, not admitted their parents were guilty. It's something else to say, my parents could have saved themselves and prevented us from becoming orphans had they told the truth. And in essence, what that means is their parents cared more for their cause than for their own children. That's a tough thing, I think.
Yes,
to
it is.
Deal with.
We go back to the phones, 591-7200. There are one or two lines available again. If you've been trying to reach us, make another try. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, when the Venona papers were released in the mid-90s, many of these people were identified by code, and they were never identified by name. What's the latest on Harry Hopkins? Was he actually an agent?
There's been one person that's written on Venona that has argued that Hopkins was a Soviet agent. I just don't find that argument very persuasive.
We should make clear who Harry Hopkins was.
Harry Hopkins is a very close aide to Franklin Roosevelt.
Who dealt with the Soviets for Roosevelt in a number of important negotiations.
Yeah, so I think the evidence is there still is not credible evidence that Hopkins was, in fact, a Soviet agent.
How about some of these people who weren't identified? Are we ever going to find out their names?
Some of them have been identified. They're not household names, and people would not recognize them. But I think it's possible that additional names will be identified over the years as people work on them. There's a book that I think will be coming out next year by Nigel West, who's a British writer on espionage. And he claims to have the identity of another atomic spy. We'll see. But I think more people will be identified over the years as perhaps more material dribbles out of Russian archives.
Thank you.
We thank you, sir. The Venona files make a very interesting story. Those aren't in the Soviet archives. We had them.
That's right. These were telegrams that the Soviet embassy and consulates were sending to Moscow and receiving from Moscow during World War II. And because of wartime censorship regulations, all overseas cables were provided to the government.
But of course they were in code.
They were in code, and American cryptographers worked really remarkable story, because this was before computers.
Mm-hmm.
And they exploited a Soviet mistake and were able to decrypt about 3,000 out of several hundred thousand messages. And we've actually found in Russian archives some material that is the same as the Venona decryptions, which gives additional confidence that they're genuine.
But there are hundreds of thousands not yet decrypted?
And never will be decrypted.
Why?
It has to do with the Russians made a mistake. They encrypted this stuff using what's called a one-time pad, which is a string of random numbers. And during World War II, they were sending so many telegrams that they began to run out of one-time pads. Again, this is before computers, where you can generate random numbers quite rapidly. And so they decided to make some of the one-time pads two-time pads, and that made them vulnerable. But only those messages that the stuff was decrypted twice, the two-time pads were used. And as I say, that was only a couple thousand out of hundreds of thousands of messages.
Are there still people in Russia, former KGB types or even present KGB types, and others who had some role in espionage operations and in Comintern operations, who still have things to tell us that we don't know about?
Yes. I mentioned Alexander Feklasov, who was the Rosenberg's controller. He's still alive, and he wrote his autobiography. Not only did he talk about the Rosenbergs, he mentioned a number of other spies that he ran. He didn't give their real names, though. He said, he was going to protect them. There are others. Some of them have talked. One of them, a former General Oleg Kalugin, now is an American citizen.
Yeah.
He was tried for treason in the Soviet Union in Russia because of his autobiography, which revealed some information. So, yeah, there are some of these people, and some of them are talking.
So there's still more to learn.
Oh, there's a lot more to learn.
There's a question here on the email. To what extent was the Communist Party able to penetrate the American news media?
They actually had some success in that. One of the people who Elizabeth Bentley ran was a woman named Mary Price, who was secretary to Walter Lippmann. And through Mary Price, they were able to get access to all of Lippmann's files. And of course, that was very valuable, because Lippmann had wonderful sources in the American government who told him things that often he couldn't print, but the material that would be very interesting to the Russians. There were a number of other newsmen that we also know were Soviet agents. One person whom there's been an enormous amount of controversy about is I.F. Stone.
I thought you were going to say Walter Duranty, but Stone is a very good case in point.
Yeah, no, Duranty was not a spy. He was just a horrible human being and an apologist for mass murder. There is a Venona cable which records an approach that the KGB made to Stone in the 1940s. His code name was Blini for the pancake.
Yeah, for a blintz.
Yeah, and the KGB approached Stone, and Stone said, "Oh, I knew you were sort of circling around. I was sort of expecting you to get in touch with me." And Stone said, "I'd love to work with you, but I'm afraid that it would be too dangerous. It would expose me, and we don't know if the Russians pushed, because that was the only cable that was decrypted. But it's clear that they made an approach to him."
Another area where the question of penetration certainly arises is American organized labor.
Yeah, and here again, the Soviets, the American Communist Party was very influential in the labor movement in the 1930s. They were very important in founding the CIO.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
And that wasn't sub rosa, that was publicly viewed.
Well, it was sub rosa to the extent that a lot of the communists in the CIO never revealed their communist identities. Mm-hmm. They were secret members of the party. They were not spies, but they were secret members of the party. John L. Lewis, the head of the CIO, was once, one of his aides once said, "John, don't you know that lots of these organizers are communists?" And Lewis's response was, "Who gets the bird, the hunter or the dog?"
Mm-hmm.
He was confident he could control them. In the late 1940s, Philip Murray, who succeeded Lewis as head of the CIO, kicked the communist unions out.
Another email. Has the recently disclosed material given any new information on Kim Philby's activities in the United States?
Yes, in a fascinating way. When the United States began to break into this material in the late 1940s, one of the people that was working at Arlington Hall, which was the location in Virginia where the cryptographers worked, was a man named William Weisband, who was a Russian translator. One day, the analysts decrypted a telegram which revealed that William Weisband was a Soviet spy. So it's clear the Soviets knew about this project, the Venona project. In 1950 or 51, the new British liaison to the American intelligence arrived in Washington, and he had some connection with Arlington Hall, and that was Kim Philby. And Philby closely monitored the progress of the project, and when it became clear that they were closing in on Donald McLean, that the telegrams they were decrypting were leading right to McLean, Philby sent Guy Burgess back to Britain to warn McLean, and then McLean and Burgess fled to the Soviet Union. So, it has shed light on Philby's role and activities.
What was Philby's assignment in the United States?
He was liaison to American intelligence.
Yeah.
From the British.
In Washington.
In Washington.
Yeah. We pause for a last round of commercials. There are, again, some lines available on our board. If you want to give us a call, move quickly, 591-7200, and if you want to email us, the address, extension 720, one word, @tribune.com. And directly back to the phones, you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, hi, Milton.
Yes, sir.
A few years ago, I was in a bookstore, and a book about World War II caught my eye. And in that book, it said that as the Soviet forces overran Germany, they came upon large amounts of American POWs. And I wanted to ask your guest if there was any truth to the fact that Stalin kept many of those POWs against their will.
I don't know anything about that.
Okay.
We do. There's some evidence that there were at least a few POWs from Vietnam that found their way to the Soviet Union. But I really just have not heard about the American POWs from World War II.
Right. Yeah, I hadn't really heard anything about it either until I saw it in that book, and I was just curious as to if you might have seen anything in the archives as you were going through them.
No.
Okay, thank you.
We thank you, sir, and let us go to this caller. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. Great,
yes, sir.
Show. I was wondering, my brother Rory asserts that, as a communist himself, that the former Soviet Union... they're basically in hibernation, and that what they're doing is they're utilizing the United States and other countries to help them build up their infrastructure. And then that, once again, at the proper time, I guess, they'll rise up and become communists.
You say you have this from your brother who is a communist? Is that what you said?
Yeah, he's very liberal, and we call him a communist.
But he's not. Is he a member of the Communist Party? You're not saying that.
No, I don't think so. But I don't think he's that radical. But he just I don't know where he got this from. But it's something that I thought about.
Well, there is, of course, a continuing Communist Party, and in the election just recently, they pulled second.
Yeah, but if that's true, that's, you know, they're even more Machiavellian than I would think that they're capable of being. I don't think there's any truth to that.
No, I don't either. Let us take one other call, and here it is. Hello, you're on the air.
Is there any evidence that Joe McCarthy ever successfully found a real live communist in all his witch hunts? That was a Soviet agent?
Yeah, he actually found a couple. There were these two librarians, Keeneys, Mary Jane Keeney and Philip Keeney, who actually did work for Soviet intelligence, and McCarthy did expose them. He exposed, you know, a couple of other people, but you know, there were so many Soviet spies, as revealed by Venona, probably over 200.
In fact, he gave anti-communism a bad name.
Yeah,
didn't he?
A terrible name. And you know, there were so many Soviet spies that if you threw a dart at enough people, you had to hit a few just by happenstance.
Yet I must ask you, in her most recent book, Ann Coulter, who was on this program once, and is a little bit too rich for my blood, so to speak, in the extremity of her rhetoric. But she's just done a new book about McCarthy, in which she says he was much vilified and persecuted, and in fact he helped save the nation.
Yeah, I just think that's dead wrong.
I do too.
You know, Joe McCarthy didn't know anything about communism. He picked it up as an issue because he needed something for his reelection, and he was a horrible senator. He was ignorant, and he did great damage to the anti-communist cause. And Ann Coulter, when she accuses Democrats and liberals of treason and so on, you know, one of the most effective anti-communists was Harry Truman, who started the Loyalty Security Program, the Marshall Plan, the Truman Plan. It was under the Truman administration that the government prosecuted Alger Hiss and the Rosenbergs. It's just nonsense to assert that that McCarthy was an effective anti-communist, or that Truman and the Democrats were somehow pro-communist.
But do you remember Dean Acheson saying, "I will not turn my back on Alger Hiss"?
Yeah, and you know, the irony, of course, is that Acheson was an anti-communist. He was also a good Christian, and mm-hmm. The reference was to kind of Christian charity. It was an unfortunate remark because it provided his enemies with an opportunity to attack him. You know, he was talking about personal friendship, and he given his position in the government, he shouldn't have said it.
I haven't asked you much about yourself and your own career, but I do wonder, from reading this book, and I've read your other books. I haven't read everything you've done, but I've read the books that you've done together with John Earl Haynes. This is the third series, or is it the fourth?
It's the fourth, actually.
Let's review that quickly. What are the other?
The Secret World of American Communism.
Yeah, that one I know.
The Soviet World of American Communism. Venona, this book. And we actually did a book called American Communism, the American Communist Movement Storming Heaven Itself. It's sort of a one-volume history of the Communist Party. We did that together as well.
And with what we said earlier about the climate in the American universities, how have your colleagues, not merely at Emory where you teach, but more broadly in the political science and in the historical professions, how have they responded to you?
Not too badly, although with this book somebody suggested I needed to go into the witness protection program. I'm regarded as a right winger and a reactionary and a crank, you know, which is kind of odd because I started out life as a liberal. I think in some ways I'm still a liberal, but the world's changed, and if people want to call me a conservative, that's fine. I think that the material that's come out of the Russian archives has strengthened my argument and emboldened people like Haynes and myself. We've got the facts, and These people can fulminate and deny all they want, but facts are nasty little things that sit there. And so I think we're making some progress.
Well, progress towards what end? What would be an ideal, what's the consummation devoutly to be wished with regard to these matters?
Well, you know, I think part of it is what students are taught. I mean, one of the reasons that I get passionate about this is because I think that there are historians that are conveying a false impression of the American past and American history. Not just McCarthyism, but it's the whole picture of America as this repressive society. It's a false picture of communism. So one thing that I'm devoted to is trying to ensure that the teaching of American history, both at the high school level and the college level, faces the truth. And I've worked with high school teachers trying to design curriculum units, and obviously hope that this kind of revision of the revisionists will begin to affect the way people understand American history.
Well, what's happened within the historical profession, particularly among those historians focused on modern European history and upon the Soviet Union, and for that matter, upon the United States, what consequence or influence have the various books that you and Haynes have done had upon discourse and, for that matter, conviction within the relevant guild?
Well, I think we're making some progress. I think that it's a lot harder for some of these people to say the stupid things they've said. You see it in some of the more recent works that these people are doing, that they're being a little more careful. They are beginning to accept the fact that these things happened. Unfortunately, some of them have said, okay, I was wrong, remarkably. On the other hand, there are also some historians that have now moved, as we call it in the last chapter in our book, from denial to justification. They said, oh, yeah, these people were spies, but they spied for a good cause. Maybe that's progress.
They're halfway or one quarter of the way
there.
That's right. It's been a great pleasure talking with you, and I do want to commend to all who are listening the new book, In Denial, Historians, Communism, and Espionage, by John Earl Haynes and by Harvey Clare. That's spelled, by the way, K-L-E-H-R, who has been our guest tonight on Extension 720. The book is published by Encounter Books, and if you're eager to buy it, you can go to any bookstore and get it. Undoubtedly, you can also get it by going to our website. If you go to WGN Radio and click on my name, which takes you to the subsite for this program, and then click on the program guide, the list of programs for the month, and scroll down to December 12th, you will find the book represented. You'll find a picture of its cover. If you click on that representation of the cover, you'll be instantly in the hands of Barnes & Noble, who will make you an offer you can't refuse in terms of a discount on the price of the book. And speaking of our program guide, I'm looking at it right now myself. When we return on Monday, we will do our quarterly book review with Alan Gittleson, Penelope Messick, and Dan Tucker. On Tuesday, something most interesting. We are close to the anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge, and three veterans of the Battle of the Bulge will be with us on Tuesday night. And on Wednesday, we discuss the case of Kathy Boudin, or Boudin, who was one of the people who robbed and the Brinks truck and killed some of the guards. And she went to prison for some 20 years, and she's recently been let out. And a book about her has been done by Susan Brody. She will be our guest, together with an old friend, David Horowitz, who will join us by telephone from Los Angeles. That's what's coming up. For now, it's time to get out of the way, and we thank all for listening and wish you a cordial good night.